Hey there, this is Bram Kanstein and you're listening to Bitcoin for Millennials. Together with my guests on this podcast, I go on a journey to discover how our current financial system works, why it's flawed, and why Bitcoin is the most relevant technology that you should understand and adopt. Today, I'm joined by Thomas Ferrer. He's the co-founder of Apollo, a platform on the Lightning Network that allows Bitcoiners to review products they love, find those they can trust, and earn Bitcoin in the process. I really love Thomas's tweets and the memes that he posts about Bitcoin, which are a great way to communicate the core message of why we actually Bitcoin, the money we use, is broken. Welcome, Thomas. This is actually round two, man.
We talked before. Great to chat with you again.
We talked before for like an hour and then realized that all the uploading and all the syncing didn't go very well. So we're trying, we're trying again. So thanks for coming on again. I first want to do like a quick check, like which generation do you belong to? Are you a millennial or?
Yeah, I'm a millennial. Yeah.
So how do you find your efforts on educating millennials? Like how's that going for you?
Well, look, I mean, I think that millennials are by far the most receptive generation to Bitcoin, or maybe Gen Z, but you know, the younger you get, the more receptive you are to Bitcoin and the less money you have to invest in it. I mean, look, one of the things that's sort of interesting is that millennials are really the first generation to predominantly take up Bitcoin. It's still not massive amongst our generation, but when you go to like Bitcoin meetups and this sort of thing, it's people our age predominantly. And it's actually not like that surprising because technology always seems to go this way. I was just like curious about this, kind of digging into it. It's fascinating actually how if you look at internet adoption, it was exactly the same. If you looked at internet adoption in say 1998, 1999, the number of people over 50 that had ever used the internet, it was like 1 in 10 people. They did surveys on this stuff, so there's like pretty good record of this. But at the same time, when it's like, you know, it's minuscule. It's 10% of people 50 plus. But then, you know, in 1998, it was like 45% for people in the 25 to 40 range. So it was already there and it was being adopted, but, you know, not by older people. And it's a pretty normal arc for technology. So I don't think, you know, well, Bitcoin's proving to be very similar.
Yeah. I personally find it very inspiring when I see like older people who are already like into Bitcoin, who had like a career in the traditional finance world, right? And eventually kind of like saw Bitcoin. Like I don't know because I didn't experience it, but I can understand like why it's very hard. You know, like I think even for us, it's been hard. And personally, I think sometimes it's still hard, you know, like you grew up in a certain system that you never really doubted, right? And now when you adopt something different, you still run into that old, like those old learnings, right? So, it's interesting to see these different generations.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's always so impressive when you do meet the relatively rare, but, you know, the boomers, that have picked up Bitcoin. And what I see in sort of that generation is that they're very receptive to the problem. They just haven't necessarily grokked or figured out that Bitcoin is the solution, but they're very receptive. You know, they understand, like, way more people, there are way more people that understand the problem that Bitcoin solves than there are Bitcoiners out there. But you know, the rare ones that can put both together, well, you know, it's very fortunate for them, and for their kids as well, I guess. But
yeah, but I would agree. Yeah, I think more people at least feel there is a problem, right? They are, well, hopefully people get triggered and they start like researching the problem. We'll have some tweets from you later on where there's like some nice illustrations of the problem. But yeah, I agree. And I think also, you know, I really want to talk to you also about like how you, you know, try to educate people and meme Bitcoin into existence, basically. And I think it's really nice how you focus on talking, I think, more about the problem than about Bitcoin. That's actually the solution, right? I think that's really good, because if people don't understand the problem, then they will never find that thread that could, you know, lead them to what we think is the solution, right?
For sure. I mean, the problem is top of the funnel, because nobody cares about, like, and it's, Bitcoin is interesting in the intricacies of how it works. It's very interesting for, you know, somebody that's already a Bitcoiner. It's endlessly fascinating, but you can't talk to somebody about the details of the way the network operates. They don't want it, like, you can't go to somebody that you just can't open with the difficulty adjustment. It just doesn't do anything for a regular person, and it's perfectly understandable. It really shouldn't. It's far too abstract a concept. So it's always, like, it's not even a Bitcoin issue. It's actually just a communication issue. You should just always start with why. Like, why should I care about what you have to say? And then when you, you know, dig into it, you can explain how Bitcoin is a solution. But if you don't start with why, nobody will be interested. So,
yeah.
And it's also, you know, the way social media works is that you do need to have that kind of ability to connect with a lot of different people to kind of be attracted to your idea in order for it to spread. So it's not a great like Twitter is not really the place to go on a deep dive into the intricacies of the network, because it's never going to have that kind of viral potential that the problem will, because that's just immediately understandable for a much greater group of people.
So what made you first become interested in investing, finance, and like what led you to Bitcoin?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I was someone like a lot of people. It just took a lot of touch points. You know, I first came across Bitcoin when I was studying it. I did like my thesis on Bitcoin at university, and I was just interested in it from it because at the time it was like the most volatile asset the world had basically ever seen. You know, since then there's been like a lot of cryptocurrencies that have, you know, come up, but at the time it was interesting even just for the volatility of it. And I just found the statistics about that very interesting. So I started looking at that, and then
study?
So I did finance and economics, but like sort of like looking at it from like a numerical techniques or statistical point of view. But so after university, I moved into sort of the traditional finance space. And that's when I actually really started to properly understand what problem Bitcoin was solving. Because when I first looked at it, I just thought it was this kind of interesting thing, but I thought it was fascinating, but I didn't really understand why we really even needed it. It was more, it's like, okay, it's this alternative payment network, but we've already got a payment network. Like, you know, and what we have, you know, feels like it works pretty well. But then when I got into investments, and the world started to essentially you know, particularly we're at this point in time where interest rates are zero and you have this massive appreciation of assets across actually everything. It was in every kind of institutional conference you went to or whatever, it was called the everything bubble. Everybody could see it. Bonds that had this 40-year bull market, equities were just constantly running up to sort of really high level, you know, high PEs and all that stuff. And it was like, hey, there's basically a bubble in everything. You know, you've got Ray Dalio out there going cash is trash. And that's the kind of stuff that I guess started to make me interested in what's happening here. And then, you know, I was talking to an asset manager who's like, he was kind of talking his book about his stocks, but what he was saying was basically the market's going to pump. And he was talking about equities, but he was banging the table in a room I'm talking to him, and he was banging the table and I'm like, why? And he's like, well, we're about to start QE2. And he's like pointing to these charts of QE1 and he's you know, showing me basically when they do QE, the stock market pumps.
And QE is the quantitative easing, right? It's the printing of money.
It's money printing, but the problem is that...
But they call it differently, right?
They call it, you know...
Essentially,
Yeah, what they do is they give it these fancy names so that it's not immediately obvious to the public about what they're doing. You know, we're doing some monetary engineering. It's based on our zero interest rate policy. We're going to do some quantitative easing. Like, what? Oh, you're printing money. Okay. But that wasn't... But once that started to become clear, it's like, okay, the central banks are printing money. It's causing an asset bubble and everything. And then, you know, 2017 came around and it was just this big wake up. I feel like 2017 was the real coming out party for Bitcoin in a way to... tell the world that Bitcoin was this serious thing to take notice of. You know, like all, you know, all the people that believed in it well before 17, you know, all power to them, but you really had to deeply understand the problems of fiat money it wasn't necessarily obvious to me at that point in time, but it started to become really obvious around that point in time. And, you know, I had to evaluate in 17 and, you know, there on after I started to evaluate, I had to revisit some of my earlier assumptions about Bitcoin. And Bitcoin has this sort of funny property to it where it's kind of an ego test. Because everybody that it's one of the sort of interesting, unique properties of it that literally everybody that buys Bitcoin could have bought Bitcoin much earlier at a much cheaper mm-hmm. price. Like there's no that's it doesn't matter what price you bought at, you could have got a lot more Bitcoin at a much cheaper price. But you decided not to
if you understood it earlier.
Yeah, if you understood it earlier. But it's, you know, every person, there's basically nobody that first comes in touch with Bitcoin and then goes, yeah, I'm going to, like,
yeah,
that's not I really agree. A thing. It's not really a thing. You have to have multiple touch points.
Mm-hmm.
And it is essentially an ego thing where you have to go, well, I dismissed it before, but was I wrong? And you have to be, like, you know, intellectually honest and sort
yes.
of, you know, have a, you know, a small enough ego.
Well, humility.
Yeah, the humility. Exactly. You have to have some humility to be able to say, yeah, I mean, I screwed up before. Actually, I was wrong. Like, I mm-hmm. wish I wasn't, but I was wrong in the past. And so you have to be able to learn from that. And that... you know, not everybody can handle that, right? That creates a certain kind of derangement syndrome for like a few, like a small percentage of the population. So that's why you still have certain people, Peter Schiff would be sort of a walking billboard of this, which is like
the gold bug. Yeah.
Not just a gold bug, but he's the type that, like, because he could have and he should have potentially gotten so much earlier, it won't matter. Like, he'll be the one of the last people to ever buy Bitcoin because it's too emotionally painful to accept the mistakes you made in the past. And it really is the kind of it, what it does is it creates cognitive dissonance in people. I was talking to a gold bug actually, and he was saying, I was talking about how really you have to essentially your unit of account should be Bitcoin, right? That's the opportunity cost of all your investments. And his response was, well, if Bitcoin is if that's the case, then look at my home. It's gone from 20,000 Bitcoin to 10 Bitcoin in the last decade.
Yeah.
And when I listened, it was like, you want to hold a deflation, like you want to hold Bitcoin because of that. Like it's like, yes. But his logic is like, well, clearly,
then I'm down.
It's like, well, it's a broken, like it's a, like, no, clearly it's just a bad network. Like it's like the Bitcoin must be broken if that's the case. It's just a cognitive dissonance is what it is. Mm-hmm. So, in some ways the people that, there will be a whole class of people, probably the boomers actually, who never even really significantly thought about investing in Bitcoins. They're not going to have that baggage of, particularly when it just becomes available via, say, the ETFs, right? There's going to be a whole bunch of people that they weren't going to buy it, the way you and I bought it. They don't want to self-custody their Bitcoin because they're just scared of technology.
Mm-hmm.
And they're scared they're going to lose it themselves. So they never seriously thought about it before. So they're not going to have that kind of baggage that has been holding them back in the past. And now it's just going to be when it does happen, it's like, oh, I can just buy it with my trade account the same way I buy buy stocks. It's going
to
unlock.
They don't
the
have
whole,
to like understand yeah. understand, right? They will stay like a few layers separated, probably.
Yeah. That's true for people, but it's also very importantly true for institutions because there's a whole class of investors that have the majority of the capital that there's no realistic way for them to invest in Bitcoin in a sort of self-custodial manner. Because it's like you go to these, 12 boomers sitting on a board of a pension fund, and it's like, oh yeah, we're going to set up a multi-sig for you, and it's like, what? Like, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be responsible for it. And it's just they're not used to that. So, they're not going to have any kind of emotional baggage with Bitcoin's past because they never could have invested in it. But once they start, what's happening is there's easier and easier investment vehicles. And when they have the opportunity to invest in it, it's just going to be like, it's just going to be, is it solving the problem for me? Oh, well.
Yeah.
And that's a question they have to face. But
they will probably only look at like the CAGR or the ROI they missed, and then they will be like, okay, I need to have this thing. Yeah, I really like what you say about that's mentioned a lot with the people that I talk to, like these multiple touch points, right? Like you wrote your thesis about Bitcoin and only a few years later you really got into it, right? Like that says a lot. Like you already spent multiple hours researching this, right? And you still didn't get it. And that's why I think this is an important message, because like once you get it and you look back, you know, then you can say things like you just said, like it's about humility. It's an ego thing. It is hard to understand. And I think for people who listen to us and other Bitcoiners who, you know, just see Bitcoin as, well, I kind of say like it's almost engineered ultimate truth, right? It's just a thing. You know, and it sounds so ridiculous, and I didn't think I would ever say this like 4 years ago, right? But but you know, here I am, and I think that looking back, of course, it's easier. And that's also, I think, a challenge for us when we talk about this or like our own journey, that we do give like context so that it's not looking down on people that don't get it, right? Because we also didn't get it. You spent probably 100 plus hours on your thesis and you still didn't get it, right?
Yeah.
So that's totally okay. I mean, it took me, I would say more than 7 years or something to really, really get it. And I'm still learning every day, right? So I think that's a very important message, that it's not coming from a place of like superiority or something, like I understand it and you don't. Know it's just really hard. And I think that in general, the message about, you know, helping people to start studying Bitcoin is honestly, I think, very altruistic. Like, please do it, you know, please dive in more, because it is just really hard. But once you start to understand it and also start to not unsee it anymore, right, then I think that will accelerate, right? Like, I think you only need like one or two things where you're like, wow, really? Does it work like that? You know, whether it's about the old system of or Bitcoin. And then you will accelerate in your effort of studying, I think, because then you really want to know more, right? There's this like place in between where I think, you know, people will dive in further. Like, what was that for you? Like, what's like the biggest thing that you cannot unsee anymore, whether understanding Bitcoin or also the stuff outside?
Well, I mean, there's a lot. I think there's a lot of different layers to it. One is all the fiat problems. I mean, understanding like fiat is actually going to infinity, and like not in like 500 years time, but like actually, well, some people, you know, we don't know for sure, but it might be this decade, and it might not be this decade. It might be in the next, certainly going to be in our lifetime.
And when you say infinity, you mean the amount of money, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And therefore, also the value down.
Right. I mean, the value, of course, yes, the value declines as the supply increases.
Yeah.
But that's only one angle to it, because what was probably maybe more important for me to understand is what makes Bitcoin, why isn't, like, the thing about the arc of technology is that there's always like a new thing that comes along that replaces the old thing. You know, Facebook replacing MySpace, and it's like, well, it's like, okay, I get the idea about cryptocurrency, say, but isn't Bitcoin just like a version one that's going to be replaced by the next thing? Because I think that there's a lot of people that get stuck on that sort of point. And that was probably one of the issues for me, where it was, you know, understanding at that point in time, particularly, I didn't necessarily have a good enough understanding of, open source software, I guess, as a whole, and understand, you know, this idea that we will, like, Bitcoin is as good as we can possibly make it today. And in the future, if there are new technologies that come along, to, like, if there's a way to make better money in the future, which there might be in some way, in the sense of something we cannot imagine about the way the networks operate, a way to make it better. What it takes, what I now understand, which I didn't back then, is that yes, that will be immediately grafted onto Bitcoin. Like whatever new kind of technological discoveries we can make along the way, that's just going to make Bitcoin stronger and better. So it's like how the right analogy is going, Bitcoin is like the internet. Everything just makes the internet bigger and stronger and better. We're not going to build a second internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just finding that right understanding about that versus, oh, we're going to find something better and it's going to replace Bitcoin. It's like, no, nothing's going to replace Bitcoin. But when, you know, humans do have a way of discovering new technologies that can make things more efficient and make things better, then when that happens, Bitcoin is going to take all those superpowers. So that was something that was because then that's when you realize, like, Bitcoin isn't going to be replaced by new technology. It just makes Bitcoin stronger. So just Bitcoin just gets stronger over time. And then look, it is nothing. The whole process is a constant discovery. There's no one point where your conviction is like, you know, signed and done. It's just like, oh, but what if this? And you have to do a deep dive and try and get to the bottom of all these deep fundamental problems, which is why, like, there are so many different types of queries of lines of attack against Bitcoin that people have addressed over the years. And the thing that is sort of great for, say, today is just that when you can think up a potential problem with it, well, there's somebody that's already thought about that problem 10 times over and it's been debunked. But that wasn't so true, you know, it wasn't true even 5 years ago, I would say. It's certainly not 10 years ago, where you had such a vast, deep amount of resources that, you know, like, not, like now, Bitcoin podcasts and videos and books are all abundant, but that wasn't a thing. That wasn't a thing 5, 10 years ago, right?
No.
So, you kind of had to figure it out yourself, and that makes it a lot harder. But now it's just the sea of information there is like, if you're willing to learn, it's all available. It's all there for you. So that's what and we're all so fortunate to be able to lean on each other like that. Like that's what makes it interesting as well, because
it's a mutual value exchange, right? Like it's not a zero sum thing. Like me making a podcast, you building a Bitcoin company, like we both try to add value and right. We get value from it when, you know, the network grows bigger, we educate more people use it, etc. Right. So it's not as in perhaps like a fiat world where there's a lot of zero sum games actually, and right. People using each other for single benefit, not mutual benefit, right?
Yeah, it's a social network. It's a social network in every sense of the word. Not just for, you know, at its core, it's an idea that's shared by everybody. That's why like it's the people that make Bitcoin. It's not the machines. And that's something that people don't. That's one of the issues that people don't necessarily understand, because they think, let me just just change the code because it's just lines of code and code is easily manipulated. And it's like, yeah, you can change the code, but you won't be able to, I try to explain this to people by, it's like, you can fork Christianity if you want. Like, you can have your own, you can have your own religion where, you know, Jesus was.
Yeah, you can take out three sins, right? Yeah. Or something.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You can create all kinds of funky rules and fork Christianity. But the problem is that how do you convince people? And it's very
well. If you think it's better, you should try it, right? That's also the comments that a lot of people share when, you know, you see these people from Greenpeace. They talk about change the code of Bitcoin. Bitcoin is destroying the world. You know, I personally think it's very malicious. Like, they're using studies that have been debunked, etc. But the entire point is, what is funny is, they don't understand Bitcoin and they have this opinion because what they can do is they can just change the code themselves because it is open source. They can copy Bitcoin, change what they think is bad, and start Greenpeace, you know, Bitcoin, the Greenpeace version, but they are actually not, they are not, right?
Yeah. Well,
but that proves the point a bit.
Well, it's funny on so many levels because not only could they do it, but if they actually did any research, they would find that, it has been done. Like, Bitcoin proof of stake exists, you know, Bitcoin proof of stake. It doesn't, there's no network adoption there because as an idea, it sucks and everybody knows that. So you can change the code to be Bitcoin proof of stake. I mean, people have already done that, but it doesn't, give you any value or create any value because you can't convince everybody else to go along with your story.
Yeah. And it's also back to that example of the internet that you gave, right? Like, in the beginning, it was obscure and, you know, like, people didn't see the value, etc. But the longer something exists and the more people join that network, the more beneficial and relevant it becomes for you to start studying it, right? So you will, in a way, get sucked into it if enough, quote unquote, you know, people around you, and that could also be true, you know, content that you consume, right? Actually see it and start participating in it and seeing the benefit of it or the value that it gives them, right? So that's, I think, in general, also, I don't know if that's the theory behind, like, the technology S-curve, right? But there's always early adopters and people who build, and then they show more people, and then it just compounds over time.
Yeah, I mean, a third of the world, as crazy it is, they're born after Bitcoin, right? Like, you know, it starts to, that's why Gen Z people generally are going to be much more and are much more receptive to Bitcoin because it doesn't seem foreign to them. It's actually always been around, and if you don't have to unlearn a whole bunch of ideas and just like, oh, okay, it's just another currency like all the other currencies, except that it's decentralized and it's a fixed supply, and then you start, then you can just start doing some basic maths on it and go, oh, okay, it's a fixed supply of 21 million and the other one's got infinity attached to it. So where would I want to put my money? And I think that definitely, like, that Lindy effect, the longer it goes, the harder it is for anybody to really question it. And that's not a Bitcoin thing, that's just true of all ideas, really.
In general, yeah. You just said unlearn. What's, like, the main thing you think people need to unlearn before they can understand Bitcoin?
Well, look, I mean, I think that there's a lot of people, particularly in the older generations, that they're just like, well, it can't be money unless it's, like, there's this idea that it's only possible to have money if the government deems it money. Like it's a wrong idea actually, but
yeah,
it's
we
this
decide
idea.
What the money is, right?
Yeah, I mean
the cigarettes are money. That's I like that example because the even though they are in a centralized controlled system, the prisoners right. still figure out how to exchange value with each other. You know, whatever that value. Whatever the value is that they exchange, they denominate it in, well, cigarettes, yeah. for example.
I think it's now that's such an important idea, and I think it's really interesting how a lot of younger generation people get it because they played, you know, computer games, and there's a lot of games out there that have their kind of You know, when I was younger, I played this game, Diablo 2. And in this game, in this world where you build up your character and you have different items and all this, there's an economy that builds in the network of people. And what happens is that there's no top-down, centralized government controlling the world of Diablo 2. It's just an emergent phenomenon. And what happens what happened, you know, when I was playing that game is that currencies emerge within the game, like where certain items start to be traded like money, because it's actually much more convenient for, and it money is just so important and so useful in society, so we don't have to be like bartering with each other, like, oh, I want to give you, you know, my sword for your shield. It's like, well, is that really worth it? It's like, well, what if we've got this like stone that we all recognize as money? Then that can make, you know, that makes things just so much more convenient and easy for trade. So money just emerges naturally. And if you see it, you know, you can read that, but you're not convinced. But once you've experienced that in the real world, like if you went to jail and, you know, had cigarettes, or if you, you know, had some kind of computer simulation of it where you're actually in a digital world and you witnessed the emergence of money, you're going to learn a lot faster. So I actually do think, and it's quite amusing to me, because I've seen a lot of Bitcoiners actually talk about playing Diablo 2 and how that, like I've seen Breedlove and a whole bunch of other Bitcoiners talking about that, and Gigi talking about that as well. And it just like, you get this sort of super interesting snapshot of real world economics, but sped up because inside the game there was, you have an evolution, you know, an emergence of a money, and then what happens in any kind of system where you have money? People start going, "How do I create more of that money?" And then you get a hyperinflation of the money, and then a new money comes up as a result that's harder than that money, and you just live through reality, but like really, really quickly.
I really like this example because I think. Well, you mentioned Robert Breedlove, right? He has the podcast, What is Money? His entire podcast is about the question, what is money, right? Because it's such a big question. I kind of follow the definition, you know, like money is a technology or something that we use to exchange value with each other, right? But when people think about money, they think about the dollar bills, right? Or the euro bills, but that's a currency. Right. So I like the gaming example because once you can trade in a certain context, trade whatever you deem has value, right? Whether in game items, whether locally, I trade my orange juice for your breads, whatever. People will find a way to find like a third thing that will represent the value, because I don't always want your bread, or you don't always want my orange juice or your shield or sword or whatever. And I think that's a really good thread for people to also like pull on, right? Because if you agree with that, and then you think further, right? Okay, well, but if the dollars or the euros that are used are defined as money, who controls the money, right? Or who should decide what that money is worth? Should the people who use the technology decide that, like in the Diablo game, mm-hmm. right? Or should a third party, some institution with other people that I don't know, should they decide what the money is worth, right? And once you start like kind of asking those questions, I think you start taking those little steps towards at least understanding like the system that you are in some way forcibly part of.
Hmm.
And also questioning your own beliefs, like, did I understand that before? No. What do I actually think about it? Well, it makes me uneasy, right? But damn, now I have to do something, right? You can stay ignorant, but I think at one point you cannot be consciously ignorant anymore, right? Because the money affects your day-to-day or weekly life and your interactions and your hopes and dreams or children or whatever. Like it's, you know, permeates everywhere.
Yeah, and the thing that's the thing about money is that there is an exchange rate that people can see. Like it's so in your face with Bitcoin. So whatever a point you became aware about it, fast forward 5-10 years, and inevitably Bitcoin is 10 to 100 times more valuable than what it was at one point. And it's really hard to ignore that forever. Like it's just extreme. Like that's why I think that's such a big reason why we get these kind of waves of adoption. I mean, yes, there's like, of course, there's like a greed element to it, right? And there's always fear and greed, but I don't think it's as simple as like fear and greed, because what also happens is there's waves of understanding.
Yeah.
And when Bitcoin, like in the next sort of bull run, and Bitcoin starts, Bitcoin's at 100,000 and higher or whatever, all these people that were looking at it, it's such a catalyzing moment for them to question their existing priors, because once you've looked at it and then got dismissed it, and then you're satisfied that it's died, and now you've been like really happy that you dismissed it,
yeah,
and then it comes back. That's such a glass shattering moment for everybody. I think every Bitcoiner has had that experience to some extent, and every person will. And it's particularly as well because Bitcoin is this social network, and so what happens also when the price goes up is more and more people are into it, and it starts to be like, is it kind of acceptable for me to be a part of this network? And only certain types of individuals want to be in at the very, very beginning, because they don't want, only certain types of people want to be doing things that most people are not. And for various different reasons, if you're like an investor, you just have career risk. I mean, even if you're managing like a pension fund or something, you might even be buying Bitcoin yourself. But
Plan B is anonymous.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, exactly. It's like you might even be buying it yourself, but it's like, why would I take, I know it's going to be volatile. I was like, why would I sort of take that risk myself? But over time, the career risk goes away because more and more people see it as being acceptable. Yes. I mean, once you have kind of head of BlackRock being like, you know, yeah, I like Bitcoin, I believe in Bitcoin, it's like, well, it's hard to laugh at somebody for believing in Bitcoin. It's just like, you're going to, you know, so, and that's just, that's true in every step of the way. I mean, that was true in 2020 when Michael Saylor really got into Bitcoin big time. And then a whole bunch of other people
dismissed it before big time as well.
Of course, he dismissed it before. I mean, that's everybody.
But I mean, to illustrate, like, that's normal.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's like, well, look, as more people you respect come into it, the fear of being doing something stupid goes away. And that and that's also why, like, you know, like Twitter or X is so important for people, because when you have that kind of network online of Bitcoiners, that's like a constant reminder, like, no matter what happens to the price, like, you're not crazy. Like, it's easy to kind of like question yourself, because you think you see something that, you know, you walk around the streets and most people most people you meet don't see what you see, and you think you see something quite extraordinary, and it's like, it's easy to question yourself. But when you have so many people that like-minded people in your kind of digital world, it provides that reassurance, which is what everybody needs, actually. So
yeah. A few weeks ago, I went to my first Bitcoin conference ever in Amsterdam, and I went to this talk, and the whole room was packed. I couldn't find a seat anymore, so I had to like stand in the back in like the hallway and look in. And at that point, I actually realized, like, damn, all these people see what I see. This is very cool, actually, to be amongst those people. And I had a lot of conversations with lots of different people, with lots of different backgrounds, and it's just really, really nice to get some confirmation, right, that you're not crazy, and seeing something. And I love that. And also, I think what I love what you said about, you know, then you see someone from BlackRock or Fidelity, you know, these people say like Bitcoin can transcend currencies and it's exponential gold, etc., you know, like, that sounds like promoting and shilling it a bit, right? Obviously, because they want to launch ETFs. But I personally have like experience in traditional finance as well, and I walked around in these corporate companies. Like, stuff like that does not get said before they absolutely know.
Right.
Even they convinced the legal lady who's in the tower on the 11th floor in the corner, where, you know, you come with your new project or idea and say like, this is what I want to do, and then she's very strict, you know, and will say, why do you want to do that, right? Like, they convinced all these people, and they took along all these stakeholders within this company, all their investors, all these things. Like, they don't say this for nothing, so they understand, you know. And for me, that's like also a nice confirmation, in the sense, like, I'd rather for those companies not to have Bitcoin and it's only, you know, just citizens like us who hold the Bitcoin and not these corporations. But when you hear something like that, you have to really think about, you know, like, they know, like, they understand. They will never say these things without actually understanding, you know. And that's something that I thought about when you just talked. And also what I think is a good awakening moment is if people go to, it's probably free, but if you go to tradingview.com, which is like a trading chart tool, we talked about like price and value, right? And when in the beginning you talked about like houses going up, but the houses go up in the number of the currency, right? And when you say like the currencies will go to infinity, it's mainly the units will go to infinity, but the value will go down, right? So the value of a house or houses has not really changed. Yes, the price, the number people see, right? But the value, yeah, a house is not more important than 100 years ago, right? A roof and walls and windows. So I saw this, British Hoddle shared this on Twitter. If you go to tradingview.com and you first take like S&P 500, NASDAQ, gold, housing market index, and you put it in price, you see it's all going up. Right, so the units of the of the currency, they're all going up. But when you put it in M2, which is the money supply, everything is down. You can pick any asset, any big category of assets, and everything is down except one. And that is just so crazy to see. Like, that really doesn't make this an opinion, right? Like, it's actually happening, and I would love to share that with more people. Like, when people like you and I talk like this about Bitcoin, it's not opinions. Like, this is actually happening, all outside of our influence. This is already happening, right? So please look at that. If you don't want to listen to a person, just look at that screen and think about what that tells you.
Yeah, and I think you made a really salient point about it's all out of our influence. It's completely out of our influence, which is why like part of why I guess Kat wants to say hello.
No worries. Hey, Kat.
Which is why it's part of why like I feel so comfortable openly advocating for Bitcoin like on Twitter to people, because it's like, so you're not
yeah,
doing
it's not
it.
Like, you are the founder and you're shilling it, like, that's not what's happening.
No, and by the way, like, there's no world in which I would like, I can't, there's nothing I can do to, you know, move the needle on the price, right? Like, I can't, like if somebody, like, I talk to somebody and I'm like, I genuinely, like, for me personally, I don't care whether you buy or sell. Like, it doesn't affect me at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for you, I would recommend you get some Bitcoin. I think so, because I can see what's happening. I can see what's happening to, you know, I can see what's happened to these fiat currencies, and I can see what's happening to Bitcoin, and it's very obvious to me. But you know, there's nothing that I can do to influence that, right? So this is a phenomenon that's happening regardless. Now, I do think that there may be small cases around the edge where I can't affect Bitcoin, but I can definitely affect the people around me. I can definitely help more people, you know, get onto the lifeboat of Bitcoin, and I want to. But ultimately, these are forces far greater than any individual, right? This is like Bitcoin is, you know. Honestly, it's 10,000 years in the making if you look at monetary history, right? So this is just the natural evolution of it's a natural evolution of money. It's like we just happen to be on the tip of the spear of it, because it's, you know, 2023 and we happen to be alive in this moment. But like, it's a just like an incredible situation to be a part of, really.
Yeah, well, and not during the seashell or the glass beads era, right? So we are just lucky. I agree. Well, but you are doing something. You are actually with your brother, you are building a company called Apollo. Can you share a bit about that? Like, why? How did you get started building that? And like, what do you do? And how do you see its future?
Yeah, sure. So look. It's three of us. It's myself. It's my brother Julian, who's the CEO, and our other co-founder Sahil. And what we're building is Essentially, it's a place, it's a platform to discover and compare Bitcoin products and services. But what we're trying to do is really kind of bridge the trust gap that people have, you know, not just like with Bitcoin, but also with the kind of services that come along with it, and try and bring sort of, I guess sort of decentralize that in some sense by using user reviews to actually sort of separate the signal from the noise with regards to these, you know, different products in the industry. We had, you know, what happened last couple of years with FTX was a disaster, right? We never want to have that happen again. And if we had, you know, a platform where you could actually find out what's valuable and what's not, it would just be so useful. And so that's what we're building. And the way we do that is we're trying to source reviews for products. And the cool thing about it with, you know, sort of being able to use Bitcoin as a payment network via the Lightning Network is that it means you can make instant global payments to people all over the world at zero fees, which is kind of like magic, actually. You can make these micro payments to people. And so you can incentivize people to come write a review, and they're just more likely to, you know, they come to we get people from all over the world writing reviews of these products, and they do it because they get paid in Bitcoin to write the reviews. So it kind of creates a really nice flywheel of value for everybody, really. You have the people that come in and they get paid, you know, for their time to write a review, and then it creates all this valuable content that then we can aggregate and present and just find like a really great source for other people to come in and be like, oh, you know, I want to discover and compare products, and now I've got a better tool to do so. So that's really our focus.
Very cool. Yeah, I love that you're doing that with your brother too. Must be a fun endeavor. And also, I thought about this last week, like the next 40 or 50 years, we're going to be talking about Bitcoin, right? Like that's also the timeline of your company. Like you are building towards the future. So it's really cool.
Well, look, that's the thing about it is that from a self-interest point of view, we want to attach ourselves to this wave because we know, you know, it's like every business has to be built on some sort of, you know, secret or something that you know that other people don't. And it's like, we know there's this absolute wave of adoption coming for Bitcoin. And so we can, be there to help facilitate that and, you know, provide value to people to that. So it just like, we know this wave is coming. We have no doubt about that. And so we just want to be able to be there to provide value to people when they do come, because that's, you know, like that's the foundation of a good business. So because the foundation is, you know, so fundamentally excited and bullish about Bitcoin adoption that it just makes so much sense to take that kind of macro trend and build a business on it. And then it just so happens that, you know, through the Lightning Network, we're able to use these like micro payments to do something cool that just like wasn't, you know, feasibly possible before, but is now. So
Very cool. I will follow it with great attention, and excited to see where it goes. To round up, like I wanted to dive into some of your tweets.
Cool.
You know how you are memeing Bitcoin into existence, but I'm going to share my screen here and see if that works. Oh, that works perfectly. That's great. I love this one. For the people who are not watching, it's the text is, if you don't believe me or don't get it, I will try to explain it to you because this is very important. And it's a picture that shows the price of one OZ, one ounce, is that ounce?
Yeah, one ounce of gold.
One ounce. An ounce of gold coin Yeah. You explain.
Well, look, it's an ounce of gold coin in 1933, and so the fiat to pay for that, and then all the fiat to get that same amount of gold in 2020, and you got this huge bundle of cash. And the caption is obviously a play on the very famous Satoshi Nakamoto quote, where he says, actually the opposite. He says, look, if you don't get it, you don't believe me. I don't have time to explain it to you. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This ties back into what we talked about, right? The 1 ounce gold coin did not change. 1 ounce of gold is 1 ounce of gold, right?
Yeah.
The number of currency units, the dollar in this example, that you needed in 1933 was 20.67. But because of all the money printing, there are more currency units, but their value goes down, whereas the value of the gold coin stayed the same, right? So the currency in this case is the denominator of that same piece of gold. And now you need 1,770 units of the same thing, the same dollars, right?
Look, and it's funny because I there's a lot of people in the replies to that tweet about saying this is why gold, and it's like look, gold was the strongest, hardest money in the universe until Bitcoin came around. Yes, it is true. If this was 50 years ago, if we were talking 50 years ago and we were having this conversation, we'd probably be saying, get your gold bars. But something has been made better. It's been digitally transformed into something that's harder to make, easier to transfer. It's just better, and it's synthetically perfect. It's synthetically perfect money is what it is. And so it's like, people can interpret that as the gold thing is interesting to me because what it does is it's an intelligence test in a way. It kind of exposes the people that they're kind of gold bugs, but they don't know why they're gold bugs. They're gold bugs, but they're gold bugs because it's like, oh yeah, because history. You can think that way, but that's not very smart. You should actually try and understand why gold had these properties over this time.
Mm-hmm.
And some people get that and some people don't, but that's what this tweet is about.
Yeah. The next one says, capitalized letters, it says Bitcoin, and you shared an image of a text. Where is that from? Do you remember?
Yeah, it's a quote from Wei Dai. A hugely influential cryptographer. It speaks for itself, but I think that this is if it's not obvious that this is happening, it particularly over the last few years, then I don't know why. I don't know how. I mean, maybe I had look.
And the quote is happening. You mean reducing the freedom of the citizens?
Yeah. The quote says, "There's never been a government that didn't sooner or later try to reduce the freedom, of its subjects and gain more control over them." And he goes on to talk about how we have to make it. We have to use the technology to make that impossible for the government because it's an inevitability of government. I mean, this is a comment on. It's not a comment about any particular government. It's actually just a comment about human nature. For I think it's very obviously the case. This would be harder to pitch to somebody 10 years ago. But we, you know, if you live through the COVID experience, which we all did, then it shouldn't be all that controversial an idea, right? It should be pretty stark and obvious to people. But I think.
This is for people in Western countries, I'd say, right? I mean, there's a lot of countries that 20 years ago also experienced this, right? So I think this is especially confrontational for people in Western countries, and I think. I usually think that, like, we grew up in such a great time and everything went well and there was always money and water and food and whatever. Like, people didn't think about the government or the incentives that are there or not, right? Or like the type of zero-sum game that they are part of, or the people in it are part of, right? And so that's also why sooner or later something like this will happen, right? It's not, again, like, I think that this is something that is not really an opinion. Like, if you look at history, this has happened over and over, and these were not differently wired people than what we are now, right? So it's again, I think something that when you share it, a lot of people think like, oh, that might be your opinion, but it's actually just a reflection on stuff that happened.
It's a lesson of history. Yeah, exactly.
this picture is from Breaking Bad, I think.
Yeah, it is.
Where Jesse hugs, what's his name? Walter.
Walt, yeah.
And you say, it's a lot to swallow at first. In the picture, Walter says, me. And the friend who finally researched how fiat money works is crying, etc. Why did you tweet this?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's funny, but
it's funny.
But
I mean, is this like the unseen thing, right? Like, you cannot unsee it once you see it, or something.
Well, I mean, it expresses a couple of different things. One is I think all the Bitcoiners sort of, all the Bitcoiners see that, and I'm Walt in that picture, because, you know, you've been trying to convince, you're sort of like, at a certain point along the way, it's almost, I don't know, tiring, or you see something and other people don't see it, and you don't, like, why don't you see it? It's, it can be maybe dispiriting or whatever, but then it's like when they finally see it, it's like,
it's a happy moment.
Yeah, it's both a happy moment, but you're also acknowledging,
it's a lot, you know, it's hard.
It's hard, because when you finally understand Bitcoin, you also kind of understand just how fucked up the rest of the world is. And so it is a lot, actually.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, this was great. This one I also really liked. Oh. I zoomed in on my screen. You mentioned crypto before, right? And that it also confuses people, like the other crypto assets. And you tweeted, beware of crypto, and you tweet a quote. It's apparently a Turkish proverb, but it says, the forest was shrinking, but the trees kept voting for the axe. For the axe was clever and convinced that the trees, that because of his handle was made of wood, he was one of them. Right. So I'm a cryptocurrency. I'm one of the altruistic good guy. Good guys.
Yeah.
But whereas Bitcoin is a decentralized protocol that just runs and includes lots of different discoveries, everything after Bitcoin is kind of another version. Well, how would you say that? Like a flawed version of the same thing, or an attempt at it, right? I think as there was a report by Fidelity that said that Bitcoin is akin to fire or the wheel. There's no better fire. There's no better wheel.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the thing that people have to understand is that It's because of its properties. It's because it's the only decentralized currency that isn't controlled by anyone. That makes it what it is. You know, it's not about the fixed supply. It's about the credibility of the fixed supply, because you know, like the U.S. government today, or, you know, any government today can be like, hey, look, we're not going to print anymore. I'm going to just say that. And it's like, oh, okay, then we've got a fixed supply, right? Right? I mean, it's like, well, no, because it's not credible.
Yeah, you don't let yourself be enforced, basically.
It's not just the fixed supply. It's actually the credibility of the permissionless aspect of using the money, because if I'm using you know, somebody else's coin, and then I'm the government, I can go to that person, I can say, well, you better stop them using it, you know, or I'm going to put you in jail. And they're going to comply with that. They're going to comply with that. But the magic of Bitcoin is that there's nobody to go after, because nobody controls it. So, you know, it's actually a very interesting thought experiment. Like, there could be a world in which you could, as the way the world played out, there is only one Bitcoin. But there is an interesting theoretical world where, at the exact same time that Satoshi Nakamoto created Bitcoin, you also had, say, in China, the creation of another sort of Bitcoin at the exact same time. And they developed almost and maybe, you know, people weren't talking with each other or communicating with each other. And maybe they ended up creating parallel Bitcoins. It's theoretically possible that you could have the exact same properties of Bitcoin in another network. Like, maybe if there are aliens, you know, in another galaxy, they've created their own kind of Bitcoin. Like, it is theoretically
possible. That there's another Bitcoin in general, you mean?
Yeah.
Like the same type of discovery.
Exactly. In our world, as it turned out, you know, there is only one, and you can't redo it. So you can't have another one now. But you beware of it, because when people try and, you know, talk about their other crypto, it's just a distraction, basically.
All right, last one, a Nietzsche quote. I'm not upset that you lied to me. I'm upset that from now on I can't believe you. Well, it ties into the other one with from Breaking Bad, right? Like, once you see some things and you understand that, you now understand it differently, basically.
Yeah.
There's lots of other things that you start questioning.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Nietzsche, and I think there's so much you know, we can learn from him about the way the world works, and the way you know, how to live a good life. And I learn a lot from Bitcoin as well. I would love to see you know, more of the Nietzscheans in Bitcoin. I think it's a perfect fit. I mean, Bitcoin is ultimately for everybody, I guess, but think it makes perfect sense for people that, you know, are attracted to the ideologies of both. Have a lot of similarities, I would say.
Yeah. Oh, I had another one. Oh, this was the Roman Empire one. It's a picture of a Roman soldier or leader, and he says, watching the Roman Empire collapse again, but with Wi-Fi and memes this time.
Yeah.
It's actually happening, right? It's just, we saw the TikTok trend. Why, like, what's your thought behind this one?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it speaks for itself, but it's pretty funny. And I think
it's wild, actually, I'd say, right?
It's almost absurd, actually, mm. but like it really is quite silly, really, when you think about it. But because you sort of wonder, we will never know. Well, it's not really clear whether, like, what are they, you know, when that was happening back then, did they know about the collapse? Or I mean, they obviously knew when it was collapsing, like, all about all the inflation.
For real, for real. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. They you know.
Mm.
But, yeah. I mean, look.
What I think here is, like, everything you read about something in the past feels also very distant. Like, that happened to other people. They were different than me. You know, it's just very far away. And that once you realize that you could be in the same situation,
mm.
right?
Yeah.
Then it's actually wild to think that you are aware of that you are in the situation, as where you say the people in that time, probably most of them weren't aware that they were in that situation.
Yeah, and I do think that it's not like a perfect parallel by any stretch, because we are just like, everything happens so much faster now because mm-hmm. of the technology. So whereas it took 500 years for the Roman Empire to collapse, we might see a sort of collapse and revolution and ascent very quickly. You know, I'm still, you know, in some ways, you know, I'm pessimistic when I realize, when I think about the way the world is, but I also am, you know, fundamentally optimistic about where is, like, I think that you know, like, I want to be alive in 50 years time, because I think that the world is going to be awesome. I do believe that. Even though, like, yeah, we're witnessing some sort of collapse today, and I also believe that to be true. But we're in a very strange time in the with our, like, technology adoption and
yeah, well, just, human evolution in essence,
every human is always at the tip of the spear of humanity, right? You know, every person that's ever lived is, yeah, that's been true for them. But the difference is that we, you know, like, the technology that we have is could potentially, like, it's non-linear, basically. It's non-linear. Mm. So that's why there's the potential for our living standards to, like, dramatically improve really quickly in a way that, like, wasn't really possible in the past. As long as we don't, like, you know, screw it up, which is also possible.
Yeah, it's lots of turmoil, but I agree with you. Like, the futures should seem bright to you, because we do also have, like, lots of technological advances, and it should become better.
Mm.
I love these memes. I'm definitely will link to all your Twitter. People can follow you for more. I want to ask you the last question that I ask everyone, the same thing. What's a core belief that you will never let go?
I'd have to say, you know, 21 million Bitcoin, really, because that's like that's the heart of it, right? there are some things we can talk about with Bitcoin, but that will never change.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for this conversation. Where can people follow you online and where can they find your company?
Yeah, sure. So X account is Thomas_Farrer. So Thomas and then it's underscore FAHRER. And then, you can find, Apollo, we're heyapollo.com. So, Google Apollo or heyapollo.com and you'll find that. Cool. Write some reviews. That'd be cool to see. Get some Bitcoin.
Yeah, I'll link to this in the show notes so people can find you easily. Thanks again for this conversation and let's stay in touch.
It's been a pleasure. Yeah, looking forward to it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, it would be amazing if you could rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. It will help us educate more millennials on the importance of Bitcoin. You can follow and connect with me on Twitter. I'm BramK, that's @BRAMK. And if you are or know someone who has an interesting perspective on Bitcoin that's worth sharing, hit me up. I read and reply to every single message. I appreciate your support and hope you'll be here for the next episode. Thanks for listening. Bye.